I'm in the studio here with three fun people, David Coulson, Ben Kamens, and Matthew Strauss. David Coulson is the former director of the School of Music at Western Michigan University, now a full-time faculty member, professor of composition, and...
anything else you want to put on
there. And you sent me a charming email to me and other friends saying, my student recital is this week.
Well, I think I said, this is my senior recital.
Senior recital.
Well, you know, I...
Did you not get a senior recital?
I did not get a senior recital when I was at the University of Michigan. It was either not a requirement or they wanted to get rid of me at a quicker rate, which is, I think, the truer part of it. But I didn't do a senior recital. And all the other schools I was at, University of Iowa, and then when I went to Rice to do my doctorate degree as well, I don't think I ever had a recital of my compositions. So I thought, you know, it's about time. And
no one's going to make it happen if you don't.
Exactly. And I'm just beginning to feel like I've taken everything I've learned in all of my education, and it's finally coming together at this point. And so I'm doing my senior recital tonight. And in a couple of more years, I'll do a graduate recital. And then I think I might be ready to go.
You are aging backwards, I can tell you that.
I thought that perhaps it was because you were starting to get emails from AARP, you decided to do your senior recital.
No, there's a lot of truth to that. Yeah. In fact, I did have a big birthday this last week. So for me, it is kind of a milestone, and it was kind of nice to have a program of music that I've written recently.
Who did you decide to include on your senior recital?
Well, I started out with a woodwind quintet that I wrote about 10 years ago called Mandala, which the Western Wind Quintet performed on February 1. Unfortunately, we're not going to hear that tonight because we have a member in the quintet that's ill, so we won't hear that, but it's fine. We have plenty of music. Second on the program is a set of 6 piano preludes that I've written for Laurie Sims. She performed 3 of them at the Gilmore International Keyboard Festival last spring. And since that time, I've written 3 more preludes, plus a fantasy. We won't hear the fantasy tonight, but the set of 6 piano preludes, I think, work very well together, and Laurie plays them beautifully. And then the new piece for bassoon and percussion, which will be the first performance. And I started working or thinking about this probably about 18 months ago. I contacted Ben and asked him if he would be interested in a new piece and coming to Kalamazoo to perform it. And he was very agreeable. So late last summer and early part of the fall, I completed this piece and then sent it off to Ben. And eventually, I started having conversations with Matt about coming to perform the piece, and he was agreeable. And it made a lot of sense. They both live and work in Houston, that they could put the piece together. And I couldn't be more delighted that Matt is playing the piece, and especially the first performance. And then the last piece on the program is just called Duo. And it's a duo for trumpet and piano in 4 movements, which I wrote it's been about 2 years. And it was written specifically for Scott Thornburg and Sylvia Roederer. And they gave the premiere last spring, I guess about 11 months ago. And so this will be the second performance. And they're just gems. They just play the piece beautifully. And it was actually Scott who, when I stepped back into the faculty several years ago, said to me, he says, now, you know, you need to get going and finally write that piece for trumpet and piano. And one of the connections was that my father was a trumpet player and a trumpet teacher. And he and Scott do know each other. And you know, Scott said, you know, you need to write this piece and needs to be dedicated to your father, and which it is. So it's very personal, And it's Scott and Sylvia play it with that kind of commitment.
The first thing I think of is this is my first chance to see pure David Coulson all at once. You know, every side that you're willing to present will be on display tonight. Does it also represent like different evolutions of your thought as a composer?
Yeah. I started composing when I was really young, and all my music degrees are in music composition. But for much of my career, composing has always kind of been on the side for me. I was so active as a percussionist up until 3-4 years ago, and did a lot of conducting and teaching and became an administrator. And so I was always juggling all these activities. And composition was always one of those things that I did when I could squeeze it in, usually in the middle of the night sometime and occasionally on summers. So I didn't have really the consistency of doing it on a regular basis. And since I've been back teaching in the last 2.5 years, that's given me the luxury of really focusing on composing. And so it's great, I think, in terms of my development. And I can see how my vocabulary is changing, and the way I write and the way I think about the way music is put together has really evolved in very quick ways in the last 2.5 years.
I'm speaking with David Coulson, also here in the studio, Ben Kamens and Matthew Strauss, two musicians appearing on tonight's concert, which I should tell you starts at 7:30 p.m. in the Dalton Center Recital Hall. It's part of the Bullock Performance Institute series, which is a Wednesday night series that features music at 7:30, usually a single program, or rather not split into two halves, but about 75 minutes of music. And you also have the option to arrive a little early at 7 p.m. and get behind the music with the performers as they discuss the pieces and the performances. That's at 7. The Bullock Performance Institute series is a ticketed event, and you can find out more at the School of Music website or milleraudatorium.com. That's where the ticket information can be found. Excuse me. Let's bring Ben and Matthew into the conversation. I'd like to start with you, Ben, as a professional bassoonist. How much new music comes your way?
A lot of new music can come my way, if that's the direction that I want to go. It's particularly, seems to be a fertile time now, and I have students who are really interested in the music of our time, both composed and improvised. And when I say improvised, you know, we've gotten to a point where jazz and classical are sort of meeting somewhere at, to think positively, let's call it an apex. But it's very interesting because my son, who is a trained jazz musician, has gotten very involved in improvised music outside of jazz, just in terms of free improvisation. And we've started to see he is collaborating more with people from the classical field than you would have seen in times past, which I think, it's really interesting. And it reminds me of a time when I went to my son's senior recital, which was way before David's. And his teacher, Gary Bartz, was there, who was a very famous bebop saxophone player. This was when he was graduating from Oberlin. And he knew that that my wife and I were musicians, and his response was something that has really stuck with me when we were talking. He says, it's all music. Plain and simple.
Yeah, it's a continuum, and especially the longer you spend with it, the more it's related to everything else, in an almost religious sense.
Well, when you teach it, I left the orchestra about 14 years ago and have devoted myself, at least economically, to full-time teaching. I still play a lot.
Tell us which orchestra you were.
I was in the Houston Symphony for 22 years. I played in the Houston Symphony, and I played in the Minnesota Orchestra before that, and
that's a long career as
yeah, I started when I was 3. And so I left the orchestra at a time when most people probably wouldn't do it, but I was, as they say, I was given an offer I could not refuse, which was to be a full-time professor at what I think of as a particularly fine music school. And I was finding that my tendencies were more towards working with young people than sitting in the orchestra. I had done it for over 30 years at that point, playing in the orchestra. And
so you were 33.
I was 33, that's right. Thank you. I'm just going to let that one sit right there. And it seemed to make sense for me and my interests at the time. So I do most of my playing now is done in this type of solo or ensemble playing with small ensembles. And it suits my temperament well. But to get back to your original question, I do a certain amount of new music. My own playing interests span a big range, really a large range. I also play period instruments, so I play Baroque bassoon. So I do a lot of playing on, it's sometimes called original instruments. I prefer to call it period because I have a hard time thinking of my modern bassoon as somehow being unoriginal.
Right.
But so I play a lot of Baroque music, a lot of conventional repertoire, and also this premiering this piece of David's tonight, and I'm premiering another piece in a week or so with a group in Tucson, and the opportunity presents itself pretty much as often as you want to make it present itself. People, I have noticed composers like having their music performed. The difficulty is getting them to write for the bassoon.
Uh-huh.
Because in the early 20th century, there is a very famous, a seminal work of 20th century music called Piero Lunaire by Arnold Schoenberg, which is for violin, cello, piano, clarinet, and is there percussion there?
No.
Did I get the whole group right there?
Soprano?
It's soprano.
Clarinetist.
That was it.
Clarinetist also plays bass clarinet.
Yes.
And the violinist also plays
viola. That's right.
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't think. In any case, this is a very, very, a well-known piece, and it became a standard ensemble. So what you end up with is a tremendous amount of new chamber music being written for that ensemble. And you notice there is an omission from that group, which is
flute.
Yes, that's right. Somehow they slip flute in there a lot more often than they slip bassoon in there.
The question I wondered about as a quick follow-up is the idea of, since Piero Lunaire and the whole 20th century, a lot of composers took the practice of the standard orchestral instruments and then tried to add extended techniques to create different effects in their pieces. And do you have to study extended techniques a lot to perform new music, or in particular, David's music?
David and I made a conscious decision not to include so-called extended techniques, although something that's not uncommon in David's music of the two pieces of his I've played in recent years is I have to play percussion instruments as well in this performance. I have to play the whirly tube, which is a piece of plumbing that I swing around my head, which makes a woo 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 sound. And I have to play one of my favorite instruments, the large seed pod. And bringing my large seed pod, I really agonized over this coming to Houston, was how I was going to get it through airport security. So I put it on, I wrapped it up in bubble wrap I could get off easily. And I decided I would just show it to the TSA agent up front and say, I have a large seed pod here. It's a percussion instrument. And somehow doing that seemed I had no problem getting it through security.
Maybe it wasn't the strangest thing they'd ever seen.
I assure you, it couldn't possibly be the strangest thing they've seen.
Well, Matthew Strauss, I knowing you're a percussionist, I'm assuming that new music is a huge part of your performance practice, but I could be wrong.
Sure. I mean, if piano was the star of the 20th century, percussion is the star of the 21st century, and new music. So the I'm in the Houston Symphony now. I joined the orchestra probably about a year after my friend Ben left the orchestra, and that wasn't by design. It just happened that way. And we, as a percussionist in an orchestra, of course, you're playing a lot of the standard repertoire. But even in the orchestra, there's a lot of new music being premiered and performed. And so we always have a good time with a lot of different types of colors and sounds that the composers write for. But in addition to that, I do also play chamber music, new music, small ensemble stuff. I never really left that. When I was in school, that's all I wanted to do was to play new music and play in a new music ensemble. And yeah, I didn't realize the economics of that at the time. You know, when you're 18 and 19, you know, you don't think about those things. And it's not impossible, but it's there's not a standard new music ensemble that you join and you make a salary. It doesn't work that way. You got to create your own career, which people do very well. But I also started falling in love with the orchestral repertoire, the large ensemble, and I went in that direction and went to a school that nurtured that as well, and ended up winning this job in Houston. But I never left the new music world. I had a percussion quartet for a bunch of years. We did a lot of commissions and stuff like that, and I've always done a lot of premieres no matter where I was, and people know that that's something I'm interested in and have kept on doing through the years. So it's part of who I am.
I was really, one of my most interesting conversations in the last few months was talking to a woman who had grown up as a classical pianist and went to Western, actually, studied with Phyllis Rappaport, and went on to the Manhattan or Manus School of Music in New York and was struggling along with all the other pianists. And one of the requirements was to take a non-Western music class and actually get a lesson on a different instrument. Hmm. And she ended up in a gamelan class and 3 months later moved to Bali.
Wow.
And has never really returned. That's been her home ever since the late 80s. Did you ever fall in love with a non-Western style and want to just throw it in and move on to another place on earth?
I mean, yes to the first part of the question. I have fallen in love with non-Western music and non-Western instruments, not to the extent where I've decided to move there, but you never know. I'm open. I don't know if my wife is, but we'll see what happens. And but yeah, for example, especially in the world of percussion, it's endless. For example, you have a tambourine in the orchestra, right? And then if you go around the world, there's all these different types of tambourines. So if you go to South India, there's something called a kanjira, and that's a tambourine with one jingle on the bottom. And you play the drum like a frame drum with your fingers, and you also play the actual jingle with your fingers. You hold the tambourine up vertically, right? And it's amazing what the rhythms they produce are. It's so complex and unbelievable. Then if you go South America and you go to Brazil, for Carnival, they have an instrument called the pandeiro. And that's played in a very unique way with various parts of the heel of your hand, your thumb, and the tips of your fingers. And you move the hand that's holding the tambourine to facilitate all these different rhythms. And it's I've dabbled in these things, but I've incorporated these techniques, especially of the pandeiro, into playing tambourine when I'm actually playing in the orchestra. Non-traditional ways of playing. It works, but more importantly, it looks really cool from the audience.
Well, that's showmanship and smarts, you know, bringing something that makes it actually a little easier to pull off the parts.
Right.
From other other playing traditions? Well, if you just tuned in, my guests are Matthew Strauss, percussionist, Ben Kamens, a bassoonist, David Colson, composer, and David Colson's works will be performed on what he's billing as his senior recital tonight at the Dalton Center Recital Hall. Pre-concert discussion begins at 7 and music starts at 7:30. Details at the School of Music website or milleraudatorium.com. It's a ticketed event, and tickets will be available at the door as well. I think we should take a break and hear one of the pieces you brought along, David. Which one would you suggest?
Well, let's see. Could we play a piece that's maybe not on tonight's program? Did I send Dragon Music to you?
I have that, yeah.
Could we play, you know, I have a fondness for this piece, and there's a little bit of a connection. This was written for Richard Nunnemaker, who was a clarinetist in the Houston Symphony, and the circumstances of this piece are really interesting. Dick always wanted me to write a piece for him, and I kept putting it off and putting it off again. I was so busy doing other things that I couldn't get focused on it. And this is when I was living in Northern California, and I was also teaching percussion. And my percussion students were really at a very intermediate level. And I was also teaching in a place that didn't have a lot of resources. Therefore, we had limited percussion instruments. So I created something for my percussion students to play with this fantastic clarinetist, and found instruments that, you know, there are things like tin cans and car coils and brake drums and things that you could go out and find in odd places. And I've always been fond of this piece. I think it's pretty accessible and easy to listen to, and it's fun for me because I can remember both of these people, and you're putting together a world-class musician with, you know, fairly inexperienced students and trying to create something in an environment that has a lot of resistance. So I'm fond of this piece, and I think it's good.
And the result is called Dragon Music.
Dragon Music.
We've heard Dragon Music for percussion and solo clarinet, music of David Colson, my guest here today on WMUK, who brought along two musicians, bassoonist Ben Kamens and percussionist Matthew Strauss, who will both appear performing a brand new work on tonight's concert. This concert is all music of David Colson, and it's dubbed Colson's senior recital.
Yes.
We've been talking about it this morning here on WMUK. Just a moment to appreciate and maybe a little analysis on the piece we just heard. You described it as being written for a world-class clarinet player and a student percussion ensemble. You did some very well-calculated things. I mean, the clarinet part is extremely difficult to pull off. There are parts that you just need the technique. There's no getting around it.
Yes, yes.
And during the music, you were saying how you'd actually made the percussion parts break down to manageable parts for a group of musicians?
Well, you know, one of the big challenges, I think, as a composer is, you know, many of us go to fine schools like Rice, where these gentlemen teach. And the resources for performing musicians is rich. You have great young student musicians at Rice University and a fabulous faculty. These are all tremendous artists. And as a, say, as a graduate, even an undergraduate, but certainly a graduate student composer, you know, you can write anything. And you have to be careful about anything, but you know, you can write things that are very demanding and very difficult, and likely find the people at institutions like that that can perform the music. Then you graduate and you go out in the world. In my case, my first tenure track position was in Northern California. And this was, it was a beautiful place, and I had a good life there. But it's remote, and it's basically rural. The economy is about farming, and it's a rural setting. And where I taught was a regional university. And you can decide as a composer that you're going to continue to write like you did when you were in music school, where you had great performers, in which case you're going to be sadly disappointed because you don't have, first of all, the kind of musicians likely that are the caliber of where you went to school. That's one challenge. The other challenge is this, and that is you have an audience to think about. And this is very important for us as composers, is to realize, first of all, what we're trying to express in our music and who's listening and why should they care and how do you compel them? How do you engage them? How do you give them something meaningful and purposeful to listen to that is going to impact them in desirable kinds of ways? And that changes wherever you happen to be living, wherever you happen to be working. And you have to accommodate that as an artist if you are going to remain active, if you want to be affirmed by your community, if you want to fit in. You have to understand, what is my community? And address that in your music for those for whom you are writing for, and also for those who are going to be your listeners, who are going to consume that. So in my case, going from Houston, Texas, from a large metropolitan area that's very sophisticated with lots of great musicians and people who consume very sophisticated, or I shouldn't say sophisticated, but a variety of kinds of music, and going to an area where it's more remote, more rural, and maybe not as experienced with that kind of listening. How do you do that? And this piece was very much about that, you know, having a friend come, the clarinetist who was a very good player, and having percussion students who were very modest in their experiences. And then also, you know, what instruments am I going to write for the percussionist? So in this last piece, you heard, like I said, car coils and brake drums and tin cans and things that we could put our hands on that were sound resources that produced interesting sounds that were compatible with what I was trying to express in that music. And I think that's, you know, as I look back, that was, I don't think that school, my training as a composer, prepared me for what that next step was going to be when I was finally in the world and at the beginning of making a musical life for myself. It was, you know, I think today we do a much better job of that as teachers and as institutions of talking about that and looking long-term and in a larger way, which is good. But back in my day, you know, you went to music school and you wrote really hard, fancy, maybe not so listener-friendly kind of music. And then you went on your way. You graduated and it's like, see you later. And I think for me, I've lived in numerous places and written music for numerous kinds of audiences, and you have to consider that, I think. And it's fun now for me to listen to this music because it does bring back memories of those people, that place, what I was thinking, how I was thinking, and what the impacts of that music are. And it's very satisfying.
It sets us up really, really well to have your friends here, Ben and Matthew, compare and contrast to what they just heard. And it's a very similar kind of piece in that there's a solo woodwind instrument and then percussion. So I'm curious to hear maybe Ben comparing to the clarinet part that you maybe caught a little of. Is he using it in a really melodic way as well? And is he asking you to go to the extremes of your range? And or is it kind of contemplative?
David's, excuse me, David's new piece has four sections to it. And so they're quite contrasting. So the answer is yes to all of the things that you just said. So it starts off with, it's an all percussion first section, which is extremely atmospheric, which is where, as I mentioned earlier, I'm playing the whirly tube in the large seed pod. The bassoon is sitting in a bassoon stand at that moment during this first part. And that is, I think, reminiscent of the title of the piece, incidentally, is "The Wind is Rising, the Earth Lets Itself Be Inhaled." So I play a wind instrument, which is appropriate for that. And it's, along with the wind that comes from it, you also have to have, you have to inhale to play a wind instrument. And breathing is a big part of what we think about and we talk about when you teach playing a wind instrument. But one of the most important things to remember about breathing is that every single person is an expert at breathing. Because if you were not, you would be dead. So when my students really start worrying about their how they're using their breath, I just remind them of that they are an expert at it. And to get out of their own way is one of the most important things to do with that. So the beginning is, it's full of, I would say, of wind sounds, of wind sounds, and it moves on to more of a very melodic, my part is quite melodic the moderately slow second section. And Matt, you have, I would say, snippets of melodic snippets that go on during that. When we exchange places, I think, in the third section, where you have more of the rhythmic flowing, the full line, and I have more of the melodic snippets in that. I mean, has it struck you that way?
Yeah, sure. In the second section, as Ben was just describing, it's very melodious in the bassoon, and there's interjections of various percussion rhythms that are not extremely strict. I was even encouraged by the composer to kind of stretch lines or push lines. In other words, make it more flowing. It's all about the gesture in that second movement. As Ben and I trade off these different little snippets, melodic and timbral snippets.
What does the array look like in front of you? What are you bringing?
Well, in front of me, I have a five-octave marimba. And to the left of me, there's kind of like another whole station, if you will, of various instruments. You have two tom-toms, which you could find on a drum set, but we call them concert tom-toms, right? They're used in more orchestral and chamber music settings. And we have a concert bass drum. And I use various techniques to make sounds out of all these instruments, such as if you go to the a lot of your listeners, I'm sure, remember going to the supermarket and you put in, depending on how old you are, 5 cents, 10 cents, a quarter, a dollar, and you get a super ball.
Oh, yeah.
Okay? So if you stab that super ball with a like a chopstick or a toothpick or whatever, and then you drag that super ball over the membrane, the head of the bass drum, it creates a very ominous sound, which you'll have to hear tonight at the concert. But anyway, besides that, there's also wind chimes, like metal wind chimes that I use. There's a log drum with two different pitches. There's also various different sizes and pitches of cymbals, like suspended cymbals. And there's a güiro that's mounted, so I could play the güiro while I'm playing other instruments as well. I have a bass bow in which I bow the marimba, besides playing it with standard mallets that we use to strike the instrument with. And any other instruments that I'm missing?
I think you're good. You know, one comment I'll make about the setup is that I've tried in recent percussion pieces to minimize the number of instruments. Because
really?
As a composer...
It sounds like a lot to me.
No, but as a composer, you can go crazy, right, with percussion. And I'm sure Matt could tell you 150 stories of setups. I mean, this setup is probably, on Matt's scale, is probably modest compared to what he's used to playing, you know, every week when he has to play with the orchestra or something. He probably has enormous setups. But what I've really been trying to do is become more economical and find ways to get other sounds out of the same instruments so that, you know, you can take a bass drum and you can just strike the bass drum, but then to have a super ball, you know, dragged across it creates an entirely different sound. So if on every instrument you can get two or three different sounds, and, you know, Matt being an excellent percussionist, he's always thinking about sound anyway. And so he knows where to go on the instruments to produce different kinds of sounds. But I would say, even though this seems like a big setup, on the scale of what Matt's used to doing, this is probably small. But one of the things I thought about was, you know, the bassoon is a very particular kind of instrument in a lot of ways. And you have to think about, what is the character? What? I mean, I think, you know, again, somebody like Ben, he can do anything with the instrument. He can make it sound whatever he wants to make it sound like. But I think also the bassoon evokes for me, I was trying to think, what kind of character do I want the music to portray? And this has a real, and the title sort of suggests this, right? It's really earthy. It's dark. It's got, this piece is actually part of a bigger set of, I'm imagining, that's sort of like a Seasons. And this piece is kind of like the fall out of the Seasons. It's got an earthy, you know, that smell that you get in the fall, and a dark sort of foresty quality. Imagine walking into a sort of dark, you know, fungusy kind of forest. And, you know, I think the bassoon really projects that really well. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll stop.
Ben gave us one of those perfect little nuggets of musical wisdom about breathing that I'm going to think of next time I pick up my flute. I want to hear your best suggestions for maybe organization. Like, you knowing you have to set all these things up and bring them, and like, what is your smartest piece of advice?
That's really interesting that you bring that up about organization, because percussionists, I believe, are amongst the most organized out of all of the musicians, because we have to be. I used to be extremely disorganized in everything in my life, and I believe it's percussion that changed me. It was enlightening. So, yeah, when you have these setups that David is speaking about, and he's right, this is a very modest setup, believe it or not. I just listed all these instruments. There's one setup I remember when you talk about in school, it's luxurious because you can do all these wacky pieces. And there was a piece by a French composer named Jean Barraquet, and he wrote a piece called Chant après Chant. and it was for six percussionists, I believe mezzo and piano. My setup, I think, counted 33 instruments, give or take a couple. And there were six setups like that. So you can imagine the room just needed in rehearsing this. And I remember every time I had to get to the rehearsal an hour and a half early, an hour and a half to set this thing up. Because you're not just getting the instruments out. You're placing them in such a way that you have to get from one instrument to another to another. It's choreographed. You have to figure out the setup, what instrument goes where, what makes most musical sense, what's most pragmatic as far as time going from one instrument to the next. So with all these factors, you have to become very organized. So you make lots of lists.
You do make lists.
Make lists and diagrams.
That's how you avoid leaving things in the practice room or at your house.
Absolutely. You know, it's one of those nightmares you have. Many people have nightmares about different things with regards to their work life. But, you know, one of mine is, you know, the timpani falling off the stage. Another one is, is you get to this contemporary music piece and then like half of your instruments aren't there. Because you were rushing and you're rushing to set everything up and you didn't have a list and you forgot. Oh gosh, I forgot the unclum. I forgot the third highest triangle. What am I gonna do? So yeah, you have to be extremely organized and thinking three steps ahead for any possible thing that can go awry.
Well, sorry, Matt. I just want to tell you I forgot my unclum for tonight.
Unclung.
We have exactly 3 minutes left in the hour before NPR News starts. I wanted to quickly ask about your pieces for Laurie Sims again, knowing that we're talking about the wild and crazy array and a world of percussion that allows you so many different flavors. Was it difficult to restrict yourself to the one instrument?
No, it's a lot easier. I find it really hard to write for percussion. And I tend to avoid it in general. And but writing for the piano, you know, is very difficult because you're almost immediately burdened with the decades and centuries of great composers that have written for the instrument. And it's hard to escape that. And you have to get yourself in a spot where you understand that you have to write for the instrument in your own terms. Right. You have to figure out what it is about the instrument that that allows you to create. And that once you get there, it's not so bad.
Well, Ben, Matt, and David, thank you so much for coming in and talking about tonight's concert. It begins at 7:30 p.m. Music begins at 7:30. Show up at 7 o'clock and you'll see more conversation with the artists. And this is a very exciting program of pieces somewhat old and new, but probably unfamiliar to most. And I wish you all the best of luck with it tonight. Let's go out listening to a section of your duo for trumpet and piano, David.
Very good.
And this will be performed tonight by?
By Scott Thornburg, trumpet, and Sylvia Roederer, piano.
This was originally written for whom?
For these musicians, yes.